Karelin evaded the point in the annoying way he sometimes had. The details of the World Federation have been out for a month now. Has there been a substantial increase in the 7% who don't approve of me? Or the 12% who don't know? Not yet. But that's of no importance. What does worry me is a general feeling, even among your supporters, that it's time this secrecy came to an end. Karelin's sigh was technically perfect, yet somehow lacked conviction. That's your feeling too, isn't it? The question was so rhetorical that Stormgren did not bother to answer it. I wonder if you really appreciate, he continued earnestly, how difficult this state of affairs makes my job.
It doesn't exactly help mine, replied Karelin with some spirit. I wish people would stop thinking of me as a dictator, and remember I'm only a civil servant trying to administer a colonial policy in whose shaping I had no hand.
That, thought Stormgren, was quite an engaging description. He wondered just how much truth it held.
Can't you at least give us some reason for your concealment? Because we don't understand it, it annoys us and gives rise to endless rumors.
Karelin gave that rich, deep laugh of his, just too resonant to be altogether human.
What am I supposed to be now? Does the robot theory still hold the field? I'd rather be a mass of electron tubes than a thing like a centipede. Oh, yes, I've seen that cartoon in yesterday's Chicago Tribune. I'm thinking of requesting the original.
Stormgren pursed his lips primly. There were times, he thought, when Karelin took his duties too lightly.
This is serious, he said reprovingly.
My dear Ricky, Karelin retorted, it's only by not taking the human race seriously that I retain what fragments of my once considerable mental powers I still possess.
Despite himself, Stormgren smiled.
That doesn't help me a great deal, does it? I have to go down there and convince my fellow men that although you won't show yourself, you've got nothing to hide. It's not an easy job. Curiosity is one of the most dominant of human characteristics. You can't defy it forever.
Of all the problems that faced us when we came to Earth, this was the most difficult, admitted Karelin. You have trusted our wisdom in other matters. Surely you can trust us in this.
I trust you, said Stormgren. But Wainwright doesn't, nor do his supporters. Can you really blame them if they put a bad interpretation on your unwillingness to show yourselves?
There was silence for a moment. Then Stormgren heard that faint sound. Was it a crackling? That might have been caused by the supervisor moving his body slightly.
You know why Wainwright and his kind fear me, don't you? Asked Karelin.
His voice was somber now, like a great organ rolling its notes from a high cathedral nave.
You will find men like him in all the world's religions. They know that we represent reason and science, and, however confident they may be in their beliefs, they fear that we will overthrow their gods. Not necessarily through any deliberate act, but in a subtler fashion. Science can destroy religion by ignoring it, as well as by disproving its tenets. No one ever demonstrated, so far as I am aware, the non-existence of Zeus or Thor. But they have few followers now. The Wainwrights fear, too, that we know the truth about the origins of their faiths. How long, they wonder, have we been observing humanity? Have we watched Mohammed begin the Hijra, or Moses giving the Jews their laws? Do we know all that is false in the stories they believe?
And do you?
Whispered Stormgren, half to himself.
That, Ricky, is the fear that torments them, even though they will never admit it openly. Believe me, it gives us no pleasure to destroy men's faiths, but all the world's religions cannot be right, and they know it. Sooner or later, man has to learn the truth, but that time is not yet. As for our secrecy, which you are correct in saying aggravates our problems, that is a matter beyond my control. I regret the need for this concealment as much as you do, but the reasons are sufficient.
However, I will try to get a statement from my superiors, which may satisfy you and perhaps placate the Freedom League. Now, please, can we return to the agenda and start recording again?
Well? Asked Van Ryberg anxiously. Did you have any luck?
I don't know, Stormgren replied wearily as he threw the files down on his desk and collapsed into the seat.
Karelin's consulting his superiors now, whoever or whatever they may be. He won't make any promises.
Listen, said Peter abruptly. I've just thought of something. What reason have we for believing that there is anyone beyond Karelin? Suppose all the overlords, as we've christened them, are right here on Earth in these ships of theirs. They may have nowhere else to go and are hiding the fact from us.
It's an ingenious theory, grinned Stormgren. But it clashes with what little I know, or think I know, about Karelin's background.
And how much is that?
Well, he often refers to his position here as something temporary, hindering him from getting on with his real work, which I think is some form of mathematics.
Once I quoted Acton's comment about power corrupting, and absolute power corrupting absolutely, I wanted to see how he'd react to that. He gave that cavernous laugh of his and said, "There's no danger of that happening to me. In the first case, the sooner I finish my work here, the sooner I can get back to where I belong, a good many light years from here. And secondly, I don't have absolute power by any means. I'm just supervisor." Of course, he may have been misleading me. I can never be sure of that.
He's immortal, isn't he?
Yes, by our standards. Though there's something in the future he seems to fear. I can't imagine what it is. And that's really all I know about him.
It isn't very conclusive. My theory is that his little fleet's lost in space and is looking for a new home. He doesn't want us to know how few he and his comrades are. Perhaps all those other ships are automatic, and there's no one in any of them. They're just an imposing facade.
You, said Stormgren, have been reading too much science fiction.
Van Ryberg grinned, a little sheepishly.
The invasion from space didn't turn out quite as expected, did it? My theory would certainly explain why Karelin never shows himself. He doesn't want us to learn that there aren't any more overlords.
Stormgren shook his head in amused disagreement.
Your explanation, as usual, is much too ingenious to be true. Though we can only infer its existence, there must be a great civilization behind the supervisor, and one that's known about man for a very long time. Karelin himself must have been studying us for centuries. Look at his command of English, for example. He taught me how to speak it idiomatically.
Have you ever discovered anything he doesn't know?
Oh yes, quite often. But only on trivial points. I think he has an absolutely perfect memory. But there are some things he hasn't bothered to learn. For instance, English is the only language he understands completely, though in the last 2 years he's picked up a good deal of Finnish just to tease me. And one doesn't learn Finnish in a hurry. He can quote great slabs of the Kalevala, whereas I'm ashamed to say I know only a few lines. He also knows the biographies of all living statesmen, and sometimes I can identify the references he's used. His knowledge of history and science seems complete. You know how much we've already learned from him. Yet, taken one at a time, I don't think his mental gifts are quite outside the range of human achievement. But no one man could possibly do all the things he does.
That's more or less what I've decided already, agreed Van Ryberg. We can argue around Karelin forever, but in the end, we always come back to the same question. Why the devil won't he show himself? Until he does, I'll go on theorizing, and the Freedom League will go on fulminating.
He cocked a rebellious eye at the ceiling.
One dark night, Mr. Supervisor, I hope some reporter takes a rocket up to your ship and climbs in through the back door with a camera. What a scoop that would be.
If Karelin was listening, he gave no sign. But of course, he never did.
In the first year of their coming, the advent of the overlords had made less difference to the pattern of human life than might have been expected. Their shadow was everywhere, but it was an unobtrusive shadow. Though there were few great cities on Earth where men could not see one of the silver ships glittering against the zenith, after a little while they were taken as much for granted as the sun, moon, or clouds. Most men were probably only dimly aware that their steadily rising standards of living were due to the overlords. When they stopped to think of it, which was seldom, they realized that those silent ships had brought peace to all the world for the first time in history, and were duly grateful. But these were negative and unspectacular benefits, accepted and soon forgotten. The overlords remained aloof, hiding their faces from mankind. Karelin could command respect and admiration. He could win nothing deeper so long as he pursued his present policy. It was hard not to feel resentment against these Olympians who spoke to man only over the radio teleprinter circuits at United Nations headquarters. What took place between Karelin and Stormgren was never publicly revealed, and sometimes Stormgren himself wondered why the supervisor found these interviews necessary. Perhaps he felt the need of direct contact with one human being at least. Perhaps he realized that Stormgren needed this form of personal support. If this was the explanation, the Secretary General appreciated it. He did not mind if the Freedom League referred to him contemptuously as Karelin's office boy. The overlords had never had any dealings with individual states and governments. They had taken the United Nations organization as they found it, had given instructions for installing the necessary radio equipment, and had issued their orders through the mouth of the Secretary General. The Soviet delegate had quite correctly pointed out, at considerable length and upon innumerable occasions, that this was not in accordance with the Charter. Karelin did not seem to worry. It was amazing that so many abuses, follies, and evils could be dispelled by those messages from the sky. With the arrival of the overlords, nations knew that they need no longer fear each other. And they guessed, even before the experiment was made, that their existing weapons were certainly impotent against a civilization that could bridge the stars. So at once, the greatest single obstacle to the happiness of mankind had been removed. The overlords seemed largely indifferent to forms of government, provided that they were not oppressive or corrupt. Earth still possessed democracies, monarchies, benevolent dictatorships, communism, and capitalism. This was a source of great surprise to many simple souls who were quite convinced that theirs was the only possible way of life. Others believed that Karelin was merely waiting to introduce a system which would sweep away all existing forms of society, and so had not bothered with minor political reforms. But this, like all other speculations concerning the overlords, was pure guesswork. No one knew their motives, and no one knew toward what future they were shepherding mankind. Chapter 3 Stormgren was sleeping badly these nights, which was strange, since soon he would be putting aside the cares of office forever. He had served mankind for 40 years, and its masters for 5, and few men could look back upon a life that had seen so many of its ambitions achieved. Perhaps that was the trouble. In the years of retirement, however many they might be, he would have no further goals to give any zest to life. Since Martha had died and the children had established their own families, his ties with the world seemed to have weakened. It might be, too, that he was beginning to identify himself with the overlords and thus to become detached from humanity. This was another of those restless nights when his brain went on turning like a machine whose governor had failed. He knew better than to woo sleep any further, and reluctantly climbed out of bed. Throwing on his dressing gown, he strolled out onto the roof garden of his modest flat. There was not one of his direct subordinates who did not possess much more luxurious quarters, but this place was ample for Stormgren's needs. He had reached the position where neither personal possessions nor official ceremony could add anything to his stature. The night was warm, almost oppressive, but the sky was clear and a brilliant moon hung low in the southwest. 10 kilometers away, the lights of New York glowed on the skyline like a dawn frozen in the act of breaking. Stormgren raised his eyes above the sleeping city, climbing again the heights that he alone of living men had scaled. Far away, though it was, he could see the hull of Karelin's ship glinting in the moonlight. He wondered what the supervisor was doing, for he did not believe that the overlords ever slept. High above, a meteor thrust its shining spear through the dome of the sky. The luminous trail glowed faintly for a while, then it died away, leaving only the stars. The reminder was brutal. In 100 years, Karelin would still be leading mankind towards the goal that he alone could see. But 4 months from now, another man would be Secretary General. That, in itself, Stormgren was far from minding, but it meant that little time was left if he ever hoped to learn what lay beyond that darkened screen. Only in the last few days had he dared to admit that the Overlord's secretiveness was beginning to obsess him. Until recently, his faith in Karelin had kept him free from doubts. But now, he thought a little wryly, the protests of the Freedom League were beginning to have their effect upon him. It was true that the propaganda about man's enslavement was no more than propaganda. Few people seriously believed it or really wished for a return to the old days. Men had grown accustomed to Karelin's imperceptible rule, but they were becoming impatient to know who ruled them. And how could they be blamed? Though it was much the largest, the Freedom League was only one of the organizations that opposed Karelin, and, consequently, the humans who cooperated with the overlords. The objections and policies of these groups varied enormously. Some took the religious viewpoint, while others were merely expressing a sense of inferiority. They felt, with good reason, much as a cultured Indian of the 19th century must have done as he contemplated the British Raj. The invaders had brought peace and prosperity to Earth, but who knew what the cost might be? History was not reassuring. Even the most peaceable of contacts between races at very different cultural levels had often resulted in the obliteration of the more backward society. Nations, as well as individuals, could lose their spirit when confronted by a challenge which they could not meet. And the civilization of the overlords, veiled in mystery though it might be, was the greatest challenge man had ever faced. There was a faint click from the facsimile machine in the adjoining room as it ejected the hourly summary sent out by Central News. Stormgren wandered indoors and ruffled half-heartedly through the sheets. On the other side of the world, the Freedom League had inspired a not very original headline. "Is man ruled by monsters?" asked the paper, and went on to quote, "Addressing a meeting in Madras today, Dr. C.V. Krishnan, president of the Eastern Division of the Freedom League, said, 'The explanation of the overlord's behavior is quite simple. Their physical form is so alien and so repulsive that they dare not show themselves to humanity. I challenge the supervisor to deny this.'" Stormgren threw down the sheet in disgust. Even if the charge were true, would it really matter? The idea was an old one, but it had never worried him. He did not believe that there was any biological form, however strange, which he could not accept in time and perhaps even find beautiful. The mind, not the body, was all that mattered. If only he could convince Karelin of this, the overlords might change their policy. It was certain that they could not be half as hideous as the imaginative drawings that had filled the papers soon after their coming to Earth. Yet it was not, Stormgren knew, entirely consideration for his successor that made him anxious to see the end of this state of affairs. He was honest enough to admit that, in the final analysis, his main motive was simple human curiosity. He had grown to know Karelin as a person, and he would never be satisfied until he had also discovered what kind of creature he might be. When Stormgren failed to arrive at his usual hour next morning, Peter Van Ryberg was surprised and a little annoyed. Though the Secretary General often made a number of calls before reaching his own office, he invariably left word that he was doing so. This morning, to make matters worse, there had been several urgent messages for Stormgren. Van Ryberg rang half a dozen departments trying to locate him, then gave it up in disgust. By noon, he had become alarmed and sent a car to Stormgren's house. 10 minutes later, he was startled by the scream of a siren, and a police patrol came racing up Roosevelt Drive. The news agencies must have had friends in that vehicle, for even as Van Ryberg watched it approach, the radio was telling the world that he was no longer merely assistant, but acting Secretary General of the United Nations. Had Van Ryberg had fewer troubles on his hands, he would have found it entertaining to study the press reactions to Stormgren's disappearance. For the past month, the world's papers had divided themselves into two sharply defined groups. The Western press, on the whole, approved of Karelin's plan to make all men citizens of the world. The Eastern countries, on the other hand, were undergoing violent but largely synthetic spasms of national pride. Some of them had been independent for little more than a generation, and had felt that they had been cheated out of their gains. Criticism of the overlords was widespread and energetic. After an initial period of extreme caution, the press had quickly found that it could be as rude to Karelin as it liked, and nothing would happen. Now it was excelling itself. Most of these attacks, though very vocal, were not representative of the great mass of the people. Along the frontiers that would soon be gone forever, the guards had been doubled, but the soldiers eyed each other with a still inarticulate friendliness. The politicians and their generals might storm and rave, but the silently waiting millions felt that, none too soon, a long and bloody chapter of history was coming to an end. And now Stormgren had gone. No one knew where. The tumult suddenly subsided as the world realized that it had lost the only man through whom the overlords, for their own strange reasons, would speak to Earth. A paralysis seemed to descend upon press and radio commentators, but in the silence could be heard the voice of the Freedom League, anxiously protesting its innocence. It was utterly dark when Stormgren awoke. For a moment, he was too sleepy to realize how strange that was. Then, as full consciousness dawned, he sat up with a start and felt for the switch beside his bed. In the darkness, his hand encountered a bare stone wall, cold to the touch. He froze instantly, mind and body paralyzed by the impact of the unexpected. Then, scarcely believing his senses, he kneeled on the bed and began to explore with his fingertips that shockingly unfamiliar wall. He had been doing this only for a moment when there was a sudden click, and a section of the darkness slid aside. He caught a glimpse of a man silhouetted against a dimly lit background. Then the door closed again, and the darkness returned. It happened so swiftly that he had no chance to see anything of the room in which he was lying. An instant later, he was dazzled by the light of a powerful electric torch. The beam flickered across his face, held him steadily for a moment, then dipped to illuminate the whole bed, which was, he now saw, nothing more than a mattress supported on rough planks. Out of the darkness, a soft voice spoke to him in excellent English, but with an accent which Stormgren could not at first identify.
"Ah, Mr. Secretary, I'm glad to see you're awake. I hope you feel quite all right."
There was something about the last sentence that caught Stormgren's attention, so that the angry questions he had been about to ask died upon his lips. He stared back into the darkness, then replied calmly, "How long have I been unconscious?" The other chuckled.
"Several days. We were promised there'd be no after effects. I'm glad to see it's true."
Partly to gain time, partly to test his own reactions, Stormgren swung his legs over the side of the bed. He was still wearing his night clothes, but they were badly crumpled and seemed to have gathered considerable dirt. As he moved, he felt a slight dizziness, not enough to be unpleasant, but sufficient to convince him that he had indeed been drugged. He turned towards the light.
"Where am I?" he said sharply. "Does Wainwright know about this?"
"Now don't get excited," replied the shadowy figure. "We won't talk about that sort of thing yet. I guess you're pretty hungry. Get dressed and come along to dinner."
The oval of light slipped across the room, and for the first time Stormgren had an idea of its dimensions. It was scarcely a room at all, for the walls seemed bare rock, roughly smoothed into shape. He realized that he was underground, possibly at a great depth. And if he had been unconscious for several days, he might be anywhere on Earth. The torchlight illuminated a pile of clothes draped over a packing case.
"This should be enough for you," said the voice from the darkness. "Laundry's rather a problem here, so we grabbed a couple of your suits and half a dozen shirts."
"That," said Stormgren without humor, "was very considerate of you."
"We're sorry about the absence of furniture and electric light. This place is convenient in some ways, but it rather lacks amenities."
"Convenient for what?" asked Stormgren as he climbed into a shirt. The feel of the familiar cloth beneath his fingers was strangely reassuring.
"Just convenient," said the voice. "And by the way, since we're likely to spend a good deal of time together, you'd better call me Joe."
"Despite your nationality," retorted Stormgren. "You're Polish, aren't you? I think I could pronounce your real name. It won't be any worse than many Finnish ones." There was a slight pause, and the light flickered for an instant.
"Well, I should have expected it," said Joe resignedly. "You must have plenty of practice at this sort of thing."
"It's a useful hobby for a man in my position. At a guess, I should say you were brought up in the United States, but didn't leave Poland until—"
"That," said Joe firmly, "is quite enough. As you seem to have finished dressing, thank you."
The door opened as Stormgren walked towards it, feeling mildly elated by his small victory. As Joe stood aside to let him pass, he wondered if his captor was armed. Almost certainly he would be, and in any case, he would have friends around. The corridor was dimly lit by oil lamps at intervals, and for the first time Stormgren could see Joe clearly. He was a man of about 50, and must have weighed well over 200 pounds. Everything about him was outsize, from the stained battle dress that might have come from any of half a dozen armed forces to the startlingly large signet ring on his left hand. A man built on this scale probably would not bother to carry a gun. It should not be difficult to trace him, thought Stormgren, if he ever got out of this place. He was a little depressed to realize that Joe must also be perfectly well aware of this fact. The walls around them, though occasionally faced with concrete, were mostly bare rock. It was clear to Stormgren that he was in some disused mine, and he could think of few more effective prisons. Until now, the fact of his kidnapping had failed to worry him greatly. He had felt that, whatever happened, the immense resources of the overlords would soon locate and rescue him. Now he was not so sure. He had already been gone several days, and nothing had happened. There must be a limit even to Karelin's power, and if he were indeed buried in some remote continent, all the science of the overlords might be unable to trace him. There were two other men sitting at the table in the bare, dimly lit room. They looked up with interest, and more than a little respect, as Stormgren entered. One of them pushed across a bundle of sandwiches, which Stormgren accepted eagerly. Though he felt extremely hungry, he could have done with a more interesting meal. But it was very obvious that his captors had dined no better. As he ate, he glanced quickly at the three men around him. Joe was by far the most outstanding character, and not merely in the matter of physical bulk. The others were clearly his assistants, nondescript individuals whose origins Stormgren would be able to place when he heard them talk. Some wine had been produced in a not-too-aseptic glass, and Stormgren washed down the last of the sandwiches. Feeling now more fully in command of the situation, he turned to the huge Pole.
"Well," he said evenly, "perhaps you'll tell me what all this is about, and just what you hope to get out of it."
Joe cleared his throat.
"I'd like to make one thing straight," he said. "This has nothing to do with Wainwright. He'll be as surprised as anyone."
Stormgren had half expected this, though he wondered why Joe was confirming his suspicions. He had long suspected the existence of an extremist movement inside, or on the frontiers of, the Freedom League.
as a matter of interest, he said. How did you kidnap me?